So the reading today is from Exodus 32, 1 through 14. When the people saw that Moses came down from the mountain, had not come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come make gods for us. Who shall go before us? As for this Moses, this man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Aaron is the brother of Moses. He's second in command when Moses is gone on top of Mount Sinai." Aaron said to them, "Take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So that all the people took off their rings out of their ears and brought them to Aaron. And Aaron took the gold from them and formed it in a mold and cast an image of a calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And Aaron saw this. He built an altar before the calf, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a festival of the Lord." They rose early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought sacrifice of well-being, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to revel. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down at once. Your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way I commanded them. They have cast for themselves an image of a calf and had worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so that my wrath shall burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And of you, Moses, I'll make you a great nation." But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that God brought them out to kill them in the mountain, to consume them from the face of the earth'? Why has this happened?" Moses said, "I have seen these people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone, so my wrath may not burn against them, and I'm going to make you a great nation." And then Moses implores the Lord and said, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that God brought them out to kill them in the mountain and consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn your fierce wrath, change your mind, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember Abraham and Isaac and Israel, your servants, how you swore to them by your own self, saying to them, 'I will multiply your descendants like the stars of the heavens, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your descendants, that they shall inherit it forever.'" And then the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he had planned for the people. Thanks be to God. You know, as I started this sermon last week, I wondered what made me pick it way back in early September. I mean, it's one of the suggested passages. Presbyterians have about five they can choose from. It's called a lectionary. And then I remembered I had just preached Moses' call in the burning bush. And I knew that this passage made me curious. I hadn't preached it before in my 30 years, and that's not a bad thing. It's new. But when I started to work on it this week, I thought, oh, there's a reason I hadn't preached it in 30 years. But then the fire and all the chaos and the lives being just torn apart took my mind away from the sermon. I wonder if that chaos and that fear kind of filled all your mind and heart too, and there was kind of a numbness and an overwhelmness and wondering, when will it stop? But on Thursday, I had to focus down again And then I started thinking about this wedding. I was thankful we had room. I was thankful we could be generous, but there was still a wedding to do. And then Saturday morning, I joined a bunch of you at St. John's Presbyterian Church. We put together 10,000 meals for Rise Against Hunger with four other churches. They're prepackaged, they're dehydrated. They will go all over the world to feed people. Last time we did this, our food went all the way to Afghanistan. All of us did this. We packed 10,000 meals. And we're driving back to the church. I have Brian and his husband in my car. Brian teaches Bible study every week, 10:30 at the church in the library. And he said, "What are you going to do with this passage on Moses?" And I said, "It's really curious, isn't it?" And he goes, "Yes, I love some of the facts. I wonder why they chose a calf. I mean, was it Baal? Did they just like it? Why? No one really knows." He said, "I read something that said the editors of Exodus, who were Southern, kind of made it as a slur against the Northerners because they had a calf. So it was kind of a cut." Really? I didn't know that. It made him curious. What I was curious about is the word stiff-necked people. You know, it's an insult if God calls you that. And God has called the people of God that before. It's not new. A stiff-necked person. I think of someone with a frozen neck. I had a friend who had a neck. She couldn't move it. So when she talked to someone, she had to go like this and like this. And it meant she was isolated. She didn't realize how much you need to be able to move, to be flexible. And then I looked again and studied, and I thought, it means stubborn. God is saying that stubborn people, unwilling to look right or left, they are not flexible. They're stuck in one way of thinking. And often it is not God's way of thinking. I was intrigued by one translation of stiff-necked. The people refuse to make peace with change. Stiff-necked means refusing to make peace with change. I like that one. Great for a class, not so much for a sermon. And I was the tiniest bit tempted to go and preach that great Philippians passage. I mean, it looked easier, but then I looked, oh my Lord, I'm being stiff-necked myself. It's not easy. It's not instantly revealed. I'm going to preach something else. I wanted a way out. But I breathed, and I remembered that I could trust God, that God called me and called you to this passage. And it's not always about me in a sermon, what's easy for me. So I went back and looked, where did this passage surprise me? Where did it turn me a little bit to look at it in another way? And I found myself wondering, how come those people, the people of Israel, felt like they needed an idol? I mean, really, they had gotten themselves so worked up, so scared, that they needed to make another god. If you looked at the passage, you notice when they're talking about Yahweh, creator, it's a big G. When it's those other gods, it's a little g. They were going to make a little g god. Okay, it's sideline, but I liked it. Really, this god had been pretty, the big G god, Yahweh, had been pretty stunning in their lives. I mean, just think of this. Moses had been called to leadership, and he didn't want to do it, but he went. He went to the powers of Egypt and said, "My people who are slaves, let them go home." And Pharaoh said, "Really? Not going to happen." And so he sent the plagues, a lot of them, great kind of ooey reading, and was able to convince Pharaoh and the powers to let him go. And then they got released out of Egypt, and they didn't know where home was anymore. They had forgotten. So God made a GPS. It was a fire by night and a pillar during the day, and they knew where to follow. And then they got to the Red Sea, and what did God do? God parted the sea and killed all the Egyptians. They are doing well. They get hungry. God makes manna and has water come out of a rock. They are doing really well. They're getting somewhere. And then they come to Mount Sinai, and that's where Moses goes up and encounters God. And they have this kind of confab, and They learn ways to live as a community, the Ten Commandments. God says, you are my people. And the people of Israel, they knew that something was going on. It says earlier that the mountain was covered with lightning and thunder, and the people said, you speak to us and we'll listen, but don't let God speak to us or I'll die. You know, they're thinking, okay, you just go ahead. It's great. You take it on. And there we find these people. They're camped on the base of the mountain in Mount Sinai, and Moses has been gone for a long time, and it feels like God has abandoned them. It feels like God has ghosted them. And as one person puts it, a month had passed, and then 10 more days, and the people had heard nothing from this man, Moses, who did not grow up among them and yet claimed to do the work and speak for God. Perhaps Moses was dead. I mean, what is he going to eat on that mountain anyway? This Moses, they say to Aaron in tones of distance and disowning and disaffection. We don't know where he is, so you, the one who is with us now, make something we can see. Make us something that will lead us forward, and we will follow it. I think the people of God are scared, and at the same time, they want to move forward. They want to at least go somewhere. Yet in fear, they go back to their old practice. Give us an idol. It worked really well for the Egyptians that we can see, that we can manipulate, that we can make our own. And Aaron, the brother of Moses, a second in command, says, okay, I got a plan. One commentary said that Aaron hesitated. He didn't hesitate at all. That was just some person being nice. It's like he had thought about it before. I'm going to make a calf. I'm going to make a mold. I'm going to get everything. It's going to be great. Moses ain't going to be here forever. See, Aaron and they wanted a God that they could see and touch, for life was scary, and the people, they wanted a way forward, out of the fear, out of the confusion, and yet they only caused themselves to move backwards. I think we too mistake our creations for God, our own plans, our own desires, as surely they are God's plan for us. When it's hard, we say, well, God, why did you do this to me? But it's not like when it's good, we say, oh, God, thank you for doing this for me. I think of a church that I knew somewhere in Florida, that when all those hurricanes, I mean, there's hurricanes all the time, it came and it knocked their church down and started a fire, and the fire was gone. And the people thought, we will have no more church anymore. The church building was paid off and it is not there, and who's going to give us a loan? And they thought to themselves, well, my house may have got damaged, but really, how could God do God's house? I mean, I've not lived so well, but it's the church. Why did the church get knocked out? See, you do crazy thinking in times of crisis. And I think they were angry at God and confused and scared. And then someone on a Saturday afternoon, when no one's around, went to that fire and ash damaged wreck of the church. And the person found some big timbers that had fallen down from the ceiling and a piece of a pew, and the person kind of built a table. And then they found some melted iron and shaped into a cross and put it on that table, and they just left. No one knows who did that. And then the church people started coming on Sunday at 11 because they had nothing else to do. And they were going to go anywhere. They were going to complain to God, and they were ready to lament. And they were going to complain as only a stiff-necked, scared people could do. And many came and started weeping because they saw the disaster and the wreck of their church. And then someone looked over to the side and they saw that rough table and the cross. And then other people looked. And in their tired and weary spirits, they thought, we could worship. Maybe we don't need a church building to be a church. And on that Sunday, they found themselves again as the children of God, and they worshiped. The pastor's sermon was shorter. She didn't have her notes, and it was okay. And they sang hymns. They didn't know all the words, but they could hum okay. And they heard God calling God's people and found out that they could still care as a community. They remembered the words like we see on our communion table, if Christ has no hands on earth but yours, so be the hands and the heart of Christ. I was surprised in this passage by the anger of God. I mean, God is angry. I mean, God's up on this mountain meeting Moses. He's just told him how to keep the Sabbath. And then somehow God knows that the people have made an idol. It's been 40 days. They go and they make this idol. And then God says, go down to your people. Your people have really messed up. The ones you brought out of Egypt. Really? They're not. God brought them out of Egypt. But do you know how you get mad when you're a parent and you say, your son wrecked the car. Your daughter dropped out of college. Well, not really. But when you get angry, you start saying things. Your people, Moses, have messed up. And he says, they are stiff-necked. And Moses, I want you to leave me alone so I can get really angry. Did you pick that up? Leave me alone. I'm going to get red hot and wallow in it, and I'm going to wipe them out. But you're going to be my favorite son forever. And I was surprised by Moses, who just got this promise that I'm going to be your one and only, and he's seeing God's anger, that Moses decides to be a mediator instead of the one and only favorite child. He becomes a mediator between God and God's people. The very people who grumble against him, the very people who doesn't trust him, Moses says to God and speaks to him and reminds him that it was God who brought the people out of Israel, I mean out of Egypt to Israel. He reminds God of God's power and might. Moses reminds him of God's promises to Abraham, to Isaac, to Israel, to multiply their descendants. Killing the offspring of the Israelites now would not foster a really good edge with the Egyptians. They're going to say, really? Look at what the God did to God's people. And so he makes this threefold kind of imperative. Turn your fierce anger, change your mind, and do not bring disaster on the people. It's bold but effective, and God changes God's mind. Oh my Lord, did you get that? God changes God's mind. God's plan was to wipe out the people as they deserve, and God changes God's mind. Now, I want you to be clear. God doesn't change God's mind and say, I'm going to do what Maggie wants or our plan. God says, I'm not going to punish them like they deserve. It's kind of stunning. It's grace, it's forgiveness, it's love. And as a result, God kind of changes the stiff-necked people so they can turn themselves to see God's way. To realize that they have not been abandoned, that they're not without hope. It's 40 days without Moses there. God's presence didn't leave them. Have you ever heard anyone who said the Bible's boring? Did they read this passage? I can't help to think, though, that it's just not a history lesson or story retold of old days. I kind of feel like it's a word for us too, because I think sometimes it feels like we've been ghosted by God. That sometimes we feel God's absence, and we long for a God that we could touch and see and ask questions and get a direct answer from. But I wonder sometimes if we're just asking the wrong questions or looking in the wrong place. Maybe it's not, why did God do this to me or do this to Santa Rosa? But where is God in the midst of the crisis? How is God faithful still? Maybe it's not, why did God do this to me? But the transformation comes as, how will I be God's compassion? Where will we help? Where will we make a difference? I got a text from the Interfaith Council from a rabbi who runs a big camp. It's called Camp Newman. It's up around the Napa area. Camp Newman was burned to the ground, everything. And so he had written the interfaith director and said, does anyone have a camp we can use? So I, in my perkiness, copied the message and sent it off to our own camp called Westminster Woods in Incidental, thinking, oh, I will bridge something fabulous. And this is the note I got back. Dear Maggie, or hi, Maggie, I heard that Camp Newman was destroyed by the fire. In fact, Camp Newman is quite close to my house. What a tragedy. I know it was a beautiful camp with wonderful facilities. I lost my house in the fire as well. Our manager has already made contact with someone at Newman. We're trying to make a way to make accommodations for them. We will support them in any way that we can. You know what I missed? Did you hear that? His house was destroyed. And he writes first, what a tragedy. I know how beautiful that camp was. I'm here being all helpful, and his house has been destroyed, and he still makes an effort to write me back. See, I was asking the wrong question, and that man focused me back. He kind of made me do what Moses was doing, remind myself of the compassion I am supposed to have. One pastor put it this way, it's a hard way forward that reckons with a divine presence that continues to elude our senses even as it fills and animates them. It's a hard way forward to know the pain of absence and doubt, but still choose to follow that cloud of fire, that pillar of fire in a landscape of freedom. The living link between us and our God is the one who challenges and negotiates with God for our forgiveness, for God's enduring presence among us, and the fulfillment of every promise God has made to God's people. That's kind of what it's about. That maybe even today, we stiff-necked people can hear God's willingness to forgive. The God who changes God's mind. The God who says, I will not leave you. And that we can be the church who can bear witness to God's faithful compassion and to seek reconciliation with the world. Maybe God will turn us to seek God's way once again. Amen.